Okay, so this is Bio 160, March 22nd, and we're starting to talk about blood. And blood is thicker than water. Water is just a component of blood. So as a matter of fact, if we take blood out of somebody, like here is a test tube full of blood, let's just analyze the various components that we have. Well, first, when we think of blood, as we remove it from somebody, we call it whole blood. And I don't know if you have whole blood on your sheet or not, but you do good. I updated that file, and you should actually call it whole blood because that's what everybody calls it, right? So whole blood is everything that we would take out of somebody's body. And then quickly, we would break that down into two kinds of compartments. There's something we call plasma, and it's kind of yellowish. That's the fluid part of blood. And then there are things that we call formed elements. So if we start to break that blood, whole blood down into its components, there's plasma and formed elements. And plasma is that fluid part, and the formed elements are cells. So you have living cells inside of blood as well as the fluid components. Of the fluid component, 92% is water. So water is a good solution or a good solvent. It can dissolve a lot of stuff. And it dissolves proteins. 8% of that compartment is made out of protein. So if you add 92 plus 8, what do you get? That's almost 100%. So almost 100% of plasma is water and proteins. And we got a couple different kinds of proteins. We have albumins, which help in maintaining, your blood pressure and water balance. There are globulins that fight infection. And then, of course, there are clotting factors dissolved in plasma. And clotting factors are real important because if you ever cut yourself, you just don't want all of your blood to leak out of your body. You actually want to form a clot. And there are proteins in plasma that will actually stop you from bleeding to death. And that doesn't happen to everybody. There are some people that can't clot, right? And they could bleed to death even from just a little paper cut. And I suppose now you can appreciate how dangerous that is. All right, then some minor component, we have ions, we have nutrients, gases, and waste products that can dissolve in plasma. So plasma is all of these things put together. And then there's another construct that we use sometimes that we'll talk about a little bit later in the class, and that is serum. And maybe you've heard of serum. It probably is not a real foreign word to you. All right, and what the heck is serum? If we take plasma, if we take all of these things right here, but we take the clotting factors out so that it can't coagulate, that's what we call serum. So serum is almost exactly like plasma, but it can't initiate any kind of clotting function in that fluid. Right? So if you're going to get an injection maybe of things that fight infections like antibodies, they wouldn't be given to you in plasma. They'd be given to you in what? Serum. So you would get a serum or an anti-serum. Right? And those are just things that don't contain clotting factors. All right, now what about for formed elements? What do we have in formed elements? Well, we have things called red blood cells. And red blood cells carry oxygen everywhere in your body. That's their important function. And most of your blood, these formed elements, are red blood cells. And the funny thing about a red blood cell is that they're anucleate. They don't have a nucleus. They don't have organelles. They're filled up almost completely with a compound that carries oxygen. So their function is to carry oxygen everywhere in your body because your mitochondria need oxygen in order to make ATP. Another name for a red blood cell is called an erythrocyte. So what does cyte mean? C-Y-T-E. It just means cell. And take a guess what erythro means. Real close. But it has to do with color. Red, that's right. So if we had green blood, that would be called a chlorocyte, because chloro is the name for green, but erythro is the name for red. Now, I don't know what language that is. I don't know if that's Latin or Greek. Does anybody know if that's Latin or Greek? Probably Latin. Okay, Greek. Oh, you think it's Greek? Okay, Greek. Greek to you. Okay. Okay, erythro, meaning red. So that's one kind of cell. You also have white blood cells. These do have nuclei. You can see a nucleus inside a white blood cell. It will be very prominent inside the cell. And when you look at these, they actually look kind of cream colored or white colored, so we call them white blood cells as opposed to red blood cells. And so they actually have a Greek name as well. We call those leukocytes. And leuko means, well, it just means white, I guess, in Greek, because Latin would be more like what? Blanco. Okay. Blancocyte. All right. So leukocyte. And as a matter of fact, yeah, you know what? It is Greek, because I know how we name animals. There's this nomenclature that we use, and it's a Greek nomenclature. All right. And the what's the United States, you know, every country has a symbol, animal symbol of the country. Like the state of California is the grizzly bear. But the United States has an animal symbol. Does anybody know what the animal symbol for the United States is? Yeah, it's an eagle. As a matter of fact, it's a bald eagle. What color is the bald? He's not bald. He just has white feathers, right? And his scientific name is leuko, meaning white, cephalus. And cephalus means up toward the head. Now, maybe that's Latin. I don't know. Is cephalic Latin? No, that's probably Greek, too. Okay, so leuko means white, corresponding to what? A white blood cell that you have right there. Oh, okay. I know, I get a little carried away sometimes. Okay. So those are both formed elements because they're cells. You have a lot fewer white blood cells or leukocytes, only 5%. And then you have even fewer still things called platelets. Right? And another name for a platelet is a thrombocyte. Because a platelet is a certain little cell fragment. They're very tiny, and these help blood clotting as well. They keep you from bleeding to death. They form a thrombus, so people call them thrombocytes sometimes. All right, so if you have decreased blood clotting function because you don't have any platelets, you can get those too. You can get a transfusion of red blood cells or white blood cells or platelets, depending on what you're deficient in. And if you're deficient in all three, guess what you get? Yeah, you get a whole blood transfusion. Okay? Okay. All right, so those are what we find in blood. So what does blood more or less look like? So here would be an example of whole blood right here, and if we were to put it underneath a microscope, these are what the cells look like. These cells that have a big dimple, these look like donuts right here, these are the erythrocytes, or red blood cells. And these here and here and here, those are the white blood cells, even though maybe they don't look white. They kind of look bluish in parts, but mostly white when we get them all together inside of a test tube. All right, so tell me, what's the function of these red blood cells? Carry oxygen. And these white blood cells are to? Fight infection. And then these little cell fragments over here, these are the platelets or thrombocytes. What do these do? Yeah, they prevent you from bleeding to death. So they assist in blood clotting. So those are the major functions of these different cells that we have in our body. And then what do we call all the space between these cells? That would be the plasma. That would be the fluid part. So red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets make up something we call these, what? Formed elements. And the fluid part is the plasma. Okay, so that's blood, kind of in a nutshell. All right, let's talk a little bit more specifically about red blood cells. Let me keep this right over here. Actually, I got some really other nice pictures of blood. Okay, red blood cells don't have any organelles. They can't divide. They can't reproduce themselves. They can't undergo mitosis. All right, and because of that, there's no nucleus, there's no way they can repair themselves, so they only live for about 120 days. That's not very long. All right, but they are bright red in color, and so after 120 days, they die, and guess what you have to do? You got to replace them, right? Okay. So, and if you don't replace them, what pathological condition is that? If you can't replace them as fast as they're dying off. Anemia, that's called anemia. You might be familiar with some of those terms. Okay, so they carry oxygen because oxygen binds to a chemical called hemoglobin right here. And hemoglobin has got a couple parts to it. It's got a heme, which is, well, it's not a protein, it's not a carbohydrate, it's just a molecule all by itself that your body has to build. And it combines with this protein called globin. So that's why we call it hemoglobin, because of these two molecules combining. But in order for heme to function as an oxygen carrier, it has to have this iron molecule right there. So that's really the reason why we need to have some iron in our diet, especially females. Okay, males not so much. And this is the molecule that oxygen binds to, right? Hemoglobin. And when oxygen binds to hemoglobin, it forms a compound called oxyhemoglobin. And that carries oxygen all over your body. But hemoglobin can also combine with some other compounds. Heme, it's a big, big molecule. I don't have a picture of it, but it's a big symmetrical shaped molecule that's got four parts to it, and then it can combine with other hemoglobins. And then on the very inside of this big molecule is that iron atom. Okay. Yeah, I wish I had a picture, because it's a pretty impressive big molecule. But it's neither carbohydrate, lipid, or protein. It's its own organic molecule. Okay. Now, hemoglobin can bind oxygen, but it can also bind another molecule, and that is carbon monoxide. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of carbon monoxide, but probably that's different than carbon dioxide. And this is the reason why. Well, who can tell me something about carbon monoxide? Any little thing. What kind of recollection you have of carbon monoxide? Yeah, it's a nasty molecule. As a matter of fact, it kills people. And this is the reason why. Because carbon monoxide can build to hemoglobin and form a compound called carboxyhemoglobin. And when carbon monoxide is bound to hemoglobin in this form right here, guess what? It can't carry oxygen. So when you breathe carbon monoxide, it binds up all your hemoglobin, and your blood can't carry oxygen. And remember, oxygen is necessary to make a lot of ATP. So when your body can't make ATP, then basically you're gonna die as a result of that. Okay. And carbon monoxide has a much higher affinity for hemoglobin than does oxygen. As a matter of fact, it's 210 times as great. So just very, very small quantities of carbon monoxide will bind all of your hemoglobin to where you can't carry any in your blood. So let me just draw this on the board. If we have a hemoglobin, and I'll just diagram that HB, and it's bound to carbon monoxide, right? Oxygen can evict carbon monoxide from hemoglobin, but how many oxygen molecules do we have to have around it to kick it off? Guess how many? 210 of them. So I would probably be here almost all afternoon drawing them in, right, before I get that carbon monoxide to come off of that hemoglobin. So that just illustrates for you what? Very low concentrations of carbon monoxide will basically what? Defeat all of your red blood cells from delivering oxygen to your tissues. And then you die as a result of that. So carbon monoxide is very poisonous in small quantities, yeah. As a matter of fact, this is true, because if we get enough oxygen into somebody, it will bonk that carbon monoxide off. And that's really the only good effective treatment, is hyperbaric oxygen. Yeah, just like that. So it's just playing on the affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin. Yeah. But if we keep oxygen concentration at normal levels like we have in the room, that's not enough to kick that carbon monoxide off the molecule. Okay. So, yep, hyperbaric oxygen would do it. Okay, or higher concentrations, higher partial pressures of oxygen. Now, where does that carbon monoxide come from? We produce it all the time. Whenever we burn something, whenever we take a fuel and burn it, so when we burn gasoline or diesel, or you burn a candle in your house, or burn even propane in your barbecue, All right, it produces carbon monoxide. Or if you have a heater at home that's not electric, that uses natural gas, for instance, it produces carbon monoxide. And that carbon monoxide should be what vented out of your building. So every furnace that you have has this nice chimney, so that it takes carbon monoxide out of your house. But every once in a while, that chimney doesn't work. I know in Los Angeles, probably once a year, a family is wiped out because the furnace doesn't operate properly. And it doesn't really get that cold in LA. And other cities like Chicago, New York, there's probably lots of families, probably four or five families every year that get killed because of carbon monoxide poisoning. Especially at the beginning of winter, when somebody's furnace isn't working, they'll bring in the barbecue to heat their house up and leave the barbecue on, and it doesn't have a chimney, and it will just kill everybody in the apartment or the house. So you got to be really careful about that carbon monoxide. All right, because it will get rid of hemoglobin for you. Let me put that over here. Okay. So how do you make red blood cells? All right, here's a really kind of interesting statistic. We said the red blood cells only live for about 120 days, and you have, I don't even know how many billions of red blood cells, but I do know how many die every second. There's about 2.5 million red blood cells in your body that die every second. That's a tremendous amount of red blood cells. I can't even count to a million, much less every second, right? So in order for you not to become anemic, how many red blood cells does your body have to make? Yeah, your body has to make 2.5 million red blood cells every second just to stay healthy. So I think that's a real important statistic because it tells you how dynamic your body is. You know, how involved in process your body is every second in order for you to deliver oxygen to your tissues. And so you need to have healthy red bone marrow because that's where red blood cells are produced. And red bone marrow is found in the cavities of your bones. All right, so bones are real important for producing red blood cells, in particular the red bone marrow. Your bones also contain yellow bone marrow, but that's just a storage form for fat. All right, so what does red bone marrow need in order to make a red blood cell? Well, it's got to have iron, all right? As a matter of fact, not just red blood cells, but red blood cells with that chemical compound in there. What's the name of that chemical compound again? Hemoglobin. So, and it needs iron to make heme, which is necessary to make hemoglobin. All right, so red bone marrow needs hemoglobin. It needs vitamin B12. So you need some good vitamins, and you need folic acid. That's another vitamin. And as a matter of fact, vitamin B12 is probably one of my favorite enzymes because another name for it is cobalamin. And cobalamin comes from another little strange metal that you need in order for it to work, and that's cobalt. All right, so your body needs a little bit of cobalt. That's on the periodic table over here. Cobalt, I'm sure, is CO. I don't know what the atomic number is. Anybody? 7? 27. Okay, you can go. There's 20. Cobalt. There it is, 27. Right? So this class is kind of interesting because it tells you that you need little bits of all these weird things in order to stay functional. But what's the significance of cobalt here? I mean, it's just a little thing, but it has such a major impact because you need to be making, what, millions of red blood cells every second. So you need a little bit of this particular vitamin right here, vitamin B12. And B12 is necessary for DNA synthesis. So that's necessary for mitosis of cells. All right, and if you have all of these things, red bone marrow can make a competent red blood cell that contains hemoglobin, and that's sufficient then to carry oxygen everywhere in your body. Okay, so what can stimulate this red bone marrow to produce red blood cells with hemoglobin? Well, for instance, maybe it's stimulated by low oxygen in your blood. Right, if there's low oxygen in your blood, and actually the kidney can sense oxygen that you have in your blood. If you're anemic, if you have decreased red blood cells, there's decreased oxygen in your blood. Or maybe you're not making hemoglobin because maybe you don't have enough iron in your diet. If you don't have iron in your diet, you can't make hemoglobin. It's not going to carry oxygen. Also, if you have pulmonary disease, lung disease, asthma, emphysema, or other kinds of lung disease, then you won't have enough oxygen in your body. That's going to stimulate red blood cell production. And if you don't live in Los Angeles, we live at sea level, where there's a high concentration of oxygen. If you move to some other area in high altitude, then there won't be as much oxygen. That will stimulate your red blood cell production. Has anybody ever lived in a place up in the mountains anywhere? Yeah, like where? Wow. 7,000 feet. Yeah, that's pretty high. That's a lot higher than Denver even. That's 2,000 feet higher. That's probably even higher than Boulder. That's up. That's really like up in the mountains. Yeah. Okay. Just to get to the town. Yeah, okay. That's way out there. Sounds nice, actually. Okay. Have you ever lived in Los Angeles and gone back there at all? Oh yeah. Okay. How do you feel when you get there? Are you ever out of breath or anything?
Yeah.
Okay. You get acclimated, and the way you get acclimated is because your body starts to make red blood cells. It compensates for that decreased oxygen that you're breathing, but it might take about 2 weeks to catch up. Okay, maybe the first couple of days are the worst, right? Like, I wouldn't be able to go there and start lecturing like I do because I would be out of breath. I would have to be taking breaths all the time. All right, so high altitude does stimulate red blood cell production, but it doesn't happen overnight because you got to build a lot of cells. Or if you have heart disease or vascular disease, that's going to decrease oxygen in your blood, and your body will then try to compensate by making more red blood cells. And of course, people that exercise heavily through endurance training, like running long distance and things like that, that's going to decrease blood oxygen, and your body will compensate by making more red blood cells and putting it in your blood. Okay, so there's a specific measurement that measures the amount of red blood cells that you have in your blood, and we call that measurement the hematocrit. And maybe you've heard of people that are trying to run marathons that they will actually get a shot of red blood cells. And that's cheating. Okay, I don't know if there's an easy way to catch it. That would be a way of increasing their hematocrit so that they might have better performance during that particular athletic event. All right, so let's look at hematocrit. What the heck is it? Here's a definition, and then we'll see if we can follow what that definition means. It's a percent red blood cell volume in whole blood. So what the heck is whole blood again? Let's take some whole blood out of somebody. And what do we got? We got the liquid part and the formed element part. And the formed element part is what? Mostly red blood cells. 95% of it is red blood cells. A little bit is white blood cells. And I can see some white blood cells right here. We call that the buffy coat. So if we take whole blood out of somebody and put it in that test tube and let it sit overnight, all the heavy stuff will fall to the bottom of the tube. And all the lighter, and the cells will fall to the bottom of the tube, and the lighter material, namely the plasma, will still be floating around on the top. So even if you have a salad dressing bottle at home, you can see all the heavy stuff on the bottle, you know. But there's a quicker way of doing that, and that is to take this test tube and put it in a centrifuge. And a centrifuge is you stick a test tube in and you spin it around real fast, many thousands of times a minute. All right, and that's like an artificial gravity, and that will make all the cells pull down to the bottom of the tube. And then that will only take maybe 30 seconds to separate all these different components out. And then you take the test tube out, and you see the plasma up here and the red blood cells over here. And the way you figure hematocrit is that you look at the whole volume, which is where? From here to here. So if you look at the whole volume, what percent is that? That's 100%, right? So here's 100% of that whole volume. And then if you look at just the volume of red blood cells right here, it's going to be about 45%. You can see what? Can you see from where you are that it's a little bit less than 50? Maybe you can see it's almost 50, but not quite, right? And in a normal person, it would be about 45%. But you live, if you live up in the mountain, guess what? It's going to be a little bit higher. It might be 47 or 48% red blood cells to help compensate for that. All right, so that number, that 45% of whole blood, that's what we call hematocrit. But if somebody's anemic, if they're not making red blood cells and your hematocrit goes to 40 or 35, guess what that is? That's anemia again. That would just be anemia. So hematocrit is a real important measure of how many red blood cells you have in whole blood. Okay. So how do you make red blood cells? There's a real important hormone involved in that. And it's called erythropoietin. Here it is right here. Yeah, white blood cells should be about 5%. And we don't have a common way to look. Usually we do a count. We actually count the number of white blood cells that we find in blood and the different kinds of white blood cells as well. So hematocrit is strictly for red blood cells, and there's so few white blood cells that it's difficult to measure that with this kind of technique. Like, it's really hard for me to eyeball how thick that little buffy layer is. So that's hard to read. So there's other measurements for the amount of white blood cells. But you know what? It's still real important to know clinically how many white blood cells you have and which kinds you have. So, because that would be maybe an indication of infection or cancer or leukemia or things like that. So knowing the amount of white blood cells is important too. And we're going to talk about white blood cells real soon, next. All right, so how does your body maintain red blood cell concentration? Well, your liver and your kidney, primarily your kidney, can sense oxygen concentration in the blood. And when oxygen concentration decreases, the kidney will secrete a hormone called erythropoietin. And a hormone just goes into the bloodstream, and it goes all over the body. And it eventually goes to red bone marrow, and it signals the red bone marrow to speed up the production of red blood cells. And then the bone marrow is going to take, like when you move up in the mountains or something, your kidneys are going to release erythropoietin. It's going to stimulate red bone marrow to produce red blood cells. And when the oxygen concentration gets back to normal, guess what the kidney does? It stops secreting erythropoietin because now you have the right number of red blood cells, and your bone marrow then gets turned off and you stop producing red blood cells until they start to decrease again. And that's how red blood cell concentration is maintained, through that hormone, erythropoietin. So if somebody is anemic, maybe they're on anti-cancer drugs or something that's hurting their red bone marrow, or maybe some other kinds of causes, they can get shots of what compound? That erythropoietin that will stimulate their red blood cell production so that it comes back up to normal. And usually, I think we used to get erythropoietin actually from, I think, cadavers, right, from dead people. But you know what? If you're dying because you can't make enough red blood cells, then you'd be happy to get that shot, right, even if it came from dead people. But today there's a better place where we get it, and that compound is exactly the same as erythropoietin, but it's called EPO, and that's just a genetically engineered form of erythropoietin, where we've isolated the gene in the human gene for erythropoietin, taken that gene and inserted that into bacteria, and now these bacteria can make erythropoietin day and night, all day long in a test tube. And then we come back in the morning, take the test tubes and suck out the erythropoietin and then give it to patients that need erythropoietin without having to, for instance, grind up anybody's kidneys that are dead. Is that cool? It's a lot cool. A lot cooler. All right, so don't forget, erythropoietin. And the typical shot you say is what? EPO, for instance. All right, white blood cells. What's another name for a white blood cell? Leukocyte. right? What's the name of the eagle? I promised I wouldn't do that, but haha. Leucocephalus, right? Leucocephalus, whitehead, right? So leukocyte is a white blood cell. Okay, they're white because they don't contain hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is that red-colored molecule that carries oxygen. All right, white blood cells remove dead cells and debris from tissues by phagocytosis. That's an active form, that's a form of active transport, but it can also active transport not just of molecules, but of what? Really large particles and even cells like bacteria and viruses. And that's a function to protect the body from what? Invading microorganisms. You got a couple different types. You got five altogether. You got five different types. And maybe you should know something about these first three right here. The most common kind is called a neutrophil. And maybe I'll show you what a picture of what a neutrophil looks like. So whenever you look at blood underneath the microscope, you know what? It's going to look like this pretty much. And I see what? Erythrocytes. I see a leukocyte. And this is what a neutrophil looks like. The nucleus is what? It has a bunch of different components to it, different compartments. It's lobulated. Even though that's one nucleus, it has a bunch of different compartments to it. And then this little blue guy over here, that's a platelet. It's a really small, small cell fragment. And then there are your red blood cells. It's just a really, really tiny cell. It's got a little bit of cytoplasm. And it's loaded with chemicals that help blood coagulation, but it doesn't have a nucleus, so it has a very limited lifetime. So because it's so small and it doesn't have a lot of organelles, I say cell fragments. So if you take that progenitor cell that makes this, it actually, little fragments break off of the cell. A certain kind of blood cell. I've got a little graph right here where it comes from. Probably a megakaryocyte. Okay, so here is a hemocytoblast, and a hemocytoblast can differentiate into a myeloblast, into a progranulocyte, which then can produce different kinds of white blood cells. But these platelets come from a megakaryocyte, and this megakaryocyte just fragments little pieces of cytoplasm off to form these thrombocytes. Now, I never test anybody on this picture right here. So that's not an exam figure, and you don't have to know any of these progenitor cells or anything, but if you're kind of interested, it's really interesting to see what the lineage is. All of these red blood cells come from this stem cell right here. Okay, and then they differentiate into different cell lines and eventually produce these cells right over here. Okay, so it's in your book, but I usually don't take time to cover each one of those steps and how it's controlled. Like, for instance, erythropoietin will stimulate this particular process over here. All right, there's another hormone or another chemical called Procrit that will stimulate this process over here. If somebody's low on platelets, they will get an injection of Procrit, which will stimulate just this kind of production. Yeah, that's a drug name. Yep. Yep, exactly. And EPO is a drug name, even though it's a natural compound, it's still produced by genetic engineering, so it's really a drug. Yeah. You know, I think it's exactly the same, but I think there is a new kind of EPO that is available, and somehow it's a little bit different, and I don't know what the modification is, and it might replace EPO altogether pretty soon. And as a matter of fact, it might be so soon that I might be misspeaking even. Okay, but EPO, say 5 years ago, EPO was the drug, and right now I'm not sure what the name is. Because when you genetically engineer a drug, you get a patent, and the patent only lasts a certain period of time, and then any other drug manufacturer can use that information to make new and improved drugs, so there might be new and improved ones coming out. But EPO, I think, is exactly like human erythropoietin, amino acid for amino acid. Yeah, and that's the beauty of it, because if it's exactly like what you have in your body, then there's just fewer side effects. Right, so it's nice to actually mimic exactly what's happening inside your body. Have they engineered other drugs? Yeah, the first one, and this was really important, was insulin. Okay, it was the first genetically engineered drug where somebody isolated the gene for insulin and then introduced that into a bacteria. So these bacteria just produce insulin all day long. And it used to be where people got insulin if they were diabetic was probably a cow, was probably a bovine insulin. And so that was very expensive because you'd have to grind up cow pancreases day in and day out to extract insulin instead of just programming these bacteria just to do it naturally. Yeah, so genetic engineering techniques do really simplify and make the cost of these drugs a lot less costly. Yeah. And there's, I don't know how many different kinds of genetically engineered drugs out there, but probably hundreds, but I don't know all their names. Okay, that's just two on the tip of my tongue. Okay, neutrophils. They're responsible for phagocytosis in tissues, and it forms pus at the infection site, right? So if you ever have an infection with pus, that's a whole bunch of neutrophils there doing their job phagocytizing foreign bodies that don't belong there, like bacteria and viruses. Monocytes are the largest kind of white blood cell. Monocytes are pretty interesting because they can leave the circulatory system. They're shapeshifters. They can crawl around everywhere in all different kinds of spots in your body, even in your lungs, the surface of your lungs, looking for dust particles and debris. They'll phagocytize them and get rid of that debris. And then there's lymphocytes. Right? And lymphocytes play a real important role in the immune response because sometimes they form antibodies and they make other kinds of chemicals. They're responsible for allergic reactions. Lymphocytes are responsible for rejecting grafts, like if you get a transplant, like a heart transplant or heart-lung transplant or a corneal transplant or maybe a valve in your heart. These are the kinds of cells that will reject that transplant. And so they have to be toned down a little bit because when you get a graft or a transplant, you don't want to lose that transplant to rejection, right? So then we have to do something with these lymphocytes to make them not so efficient. But in everybody's everyday life, these lymphocytes also control tumors. And probably all of us have had tumors or maybe other kinds of cancer in our lifetime, but since our immune system was working, these lymphocytes went and attacked the cancer and killed it before it became even noticeable to us. Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah. Sure. You know what? You can usually decrease that dose of immune suppressant drug, which is good because when you suppress your immune system, you won't reject the tissue, but you're going to be susceptible to infection, right? So you want to reduce it all the time, but as far as I know, no one has ever been weaned completely off of it. You always have to maintain a little level of immunosuppressant drug in your system. But you always like to reduce it so you're not so susceptible to other kinds of infections or, you know what, other kinds of tumors, right? So yeah, you want to keep your immune system, but you need to just get it right, and that's medicine. Medicine is, and everybody's different, so medicine is what? Always balancing positives against negatives, trying to figure out what's best for a particular patient or individual. Yeah, grafts are risky in any case. And there's another reason why grafts can be risky. Sometimes they're autografts, which are not so risky. And if it's an autograft, that means taking tissue from one part of your body and putting it to another part of your body. In that case, you don't need immunosuppressants, which is real good. But the other good thing about that is that if you know you're healthy, if you don't have AIDS and you don't have hepatitis, you can't get AIDS or hepatitis from yourself, right? But if you get a graft, a human graft, the transplant from another human, we can do all these tests, but guess what? Every once in a while, somebody makes a mistake, and you can get some bad diseases from a transplant. Okay? I mean, we're doing pretty good with that, but it does happen every once in a while. All right, so that's the importance of lymphocytes, these different kinds of things. Basically, they all do what? They fight infections or foreign material that finds its way into your body. Okay. white blood cells. Platelets. Talk about platelets. These are those little cell fragments that I was talking about. And so it's just a small fragment consisting of a small amount of cytoplasm surrounded by that cell membrane. They play an important role in preventing blood loss. And there are basically two ways that your body can prevent blood loss, which is a really good thing. The first process is called a platelet plug. This is for really small tears in blood vessels. And then there's a process called blood clotting. And blood clotting is for bigger tears or cuts. For instance, if you really cut yourself with a knife or maybe even a paper cut, which is pretty deep, okay, that would you would need some blood clotting right there, not just a platelet plug. So what about a platelet plug? What happens here is that you get some kind of damage, so the epithelium of that blood vessel is torn. And in that epithelium, or right underneath the epithelium, there are these fibers. Have we ever talked about collagen fibers before? Maybe you've heard of collagen? Yeah? Okay, so a collagen fibers then cause platelets to get sticky. So whenever you injure yourself and it reveals some connective tissue that has collagen, platelets start to plug up. They start to clump together. All right, and that's an active process. And the accumulation of these platelets seals these little tears shut. But how big is a platelet? Really tiny, right? So you have to put millions of them together to plug up a big hole. So they're not good for plugging up big holes. They're good for plugging up what? Really small microscopic holes in your cardiovascular system. Only really small holes, right? But the good thing about platelets is that when they become activated or sticky, they release other factors like prostaglandins and this calcium molecule right here, which can activate more platelets. And so it can plug, it can, again, just really microscopic tears in your circulatory system. So that leads us to the second kind of blood clotting. This is also what's AKA-ing. Yeah, also known as, I've used that before in some classes and I've never said what it was in there. I had a lot of students that never knew what AKA was. I guess they never had many aliases growing up. Okay, but AKA means also known as, okay, coagulation. And as a matter of fact, I would probably like for you to use that term coagulation, because they're going to use it with another term that sounds, well, it sounds a lot different, but it can be confusing sometimes, and that's called agglutination. So I definitely want you to know the difference between agglutination and coagulation. So let's do coagulation first. Okay. So blood clotting or coagulation means the forming of a clot that's bigger than a platelet plug, which is just a group of thrombocytes. And a clot is a network of thread-like protein fibers called fibrin that traps blood cells, platelets, and even fluid. All right, so fibrin is a protein that's dissolved in plasma, but when it becomes activated, these proteins come together and form this huge, like fish net. It forms this huge net wherever that tear in the blood vessel is, and as blood flows out of that fish net, guess what? It traps red blood cells and platelets, and it traps even more fibrin molecules that form even more fish nets over it, and that what? That seals off the damage to that blood vessel. And that process we call coagulation. So the compound that forms that net is, that's real important for you to know, that's fibrin. Fibrin is the protein that forms the net, that catches all that stuff that stops you from bleeding. Right? But now, do you want that protein floating around in your blood all the time? Do you want your blood... What would happen to you right now if all your blood coagulated inside your blood vessels? Yeah, you just, instead of flowing, it would just stop, because coagulated blood is a solid. Blood is a tissue, and blood has to be a fluid so that it flows around your body. And it has to be a fluid to, what, take oxygen from your lungs and let it flow to your brain, for instance. So if it starts to coagulate inside your blood vessels, well, you're a goner, right? All right, so coagulation, or the forming of a blood clot, has to be controlled very precisely. It's a very important mechanism so that you just don't go turn into this big solid plug all of a sudden. All right, so it's a three-step process. So coagulation takes these three steps or three phases in order to form a blood clot. And so these are the three steps. There's something called prothrombin activator formation, is step number one. Step number two is thrombin formation, and step number three is fibrin formation. And probably you should appreciate what? The third step, fibrin formation, that's the ultimate goal of coagulation, because it's that fibrin that makes what? What does that fibrin make? That fishnet that traps everything. Okay. Let me tell you about some nomenclature to make life easy. A lot of words begin or end with a certain little designator that tells us a lot about what the function of that word is. So if you have something that's an enzyme that will allow a certain process to take place, if there's a pro in front of it, proenzyme, then we know that that enzyme is still inactive. It's built, it's ready to go to work, but it's still held in reserve. It can't go to work because it's a proenzyme. Something, some little thing has to happen to it before it can jump into action. Okay. The same thing, if you see a word with an ogen on the end of it, that suffix, again, that means that that protein is inactive, but it's there ready to jump to action in just a moment's notice. So this is really beautiful because, for instance, if you need this proenzyme or this proteinogen right here at just a second's notice and you don't have it in this inactive form, if all of a sudden you do need it, how long would it take to make these things? It might take a week, right? But if you need it in less than a second and it's not in these inactive forms, well, you're going to be dead in a week, right? You're going to be all, your blood will be laying on the floor. So these proenzymes and proteinogens are very important because even though they're inactive, they're ready to turn on in just a second's notice. Okay, so if you see anything like that, you know it's in active form. So let's look at these different stages for a second. Okay, stage one. Now you don't have to know all of these different things, but just the general gist of what's going on here. So what starts coagulation? Just like a platelet plug, there's got to be some kind of injury to a blood vessel, right? If a blood vessel's not injured, well, then the blood's not going to want to leak out. And if the blood's not going to want to leak out, then there's no sense trying to stop blood leaking out if it's not leaking out, right? That sounds silly, but so you have to have injury to a blood vessel first. All right, and when a blood vessel gets injured, that reveals some connective tissue, like collagen, for instance. And what that does, that collagen takes inactive clotting factors and turns them into active clotting factors. And if you didn't have these inactive clotting factors in the blood, then it would take a week or so to build them up if you damaged the tissue. So it's good to have a lot of inactive stuff ready to go to work, right? And these active clotting factors, in the presence of this compound right here, what's CA? Calcium, okay? It can make something called prothrombin activator. All right, so now you know another real important part of calcium. All right, your body is always trying to figure out what's the best place for calcium. So before you took this place, where would you think you would want to have good calcium? In your bones, right? But when we studied bones, we said one of the functions of bone is that it's a storage place for calcium. So, and if you don't have strong bones, you get a condition called osteoporosis. But now here are your fates. Let me give you a choice. Where would you like to have proper levels of calcium? In bones to make bones strong, or maybe in blood so that you have good clotting function? All right, now that choice is a little bit more difficult. Right? How would it be, for instance, how would you like it if you got a little paper cut and you would bleed to death because you don't have sufficient calcium in your blood? Now what's more important to you, have really strong bones or to have good clotting function? Yeah, maybe clotting function is even a little bit more important, right? And where does your blood get that calcium in order for it to protect itself? It gets it from bones. Okay, it gets it from bones. And if you don't have good calcium in your diet, okay, then your blood will get a lot of calcium from bones and you'll get that condition called osteoporosis, because indeed I would agree probably with most students in here that it's probably more important to have good clotting function than it is to have good strong bones. right? And your body realizes that. And so that's why osteoporosis is a very prevalent condition that happens, because your body realizes that strong bones is secondary to other things that are happening in your body that need calcium. All right, so that's step number one. Step number two, we got that prothrombin activator. Okay, that will take prothrombin. So prothrombin activator can take prothrombin and convert it into thrombin. Now, what can you tell me about this prothrombin right here? Look at that word and look at the prefix of the word. Is prothrombin active or inactive? It is inactive. It doesn't work unless it's called to duty, right? And when is it called to duty? When there's an injury to a blood vessel. And this first process right here, prothrombin activator, is made. So prothrombin activator converts prothrombin into thrombin. And is thrombin the active form or the inactive form? That's the active form. And it's really good that you have a lot of prothrombin in your blood ready to come to work in just a moment's notice. It gets converted into thrombin. All right, so that's the importance of that pro right there. All right, so what does thrombin do? Thrombin is an enzyme that will take fibrinogen and convert it into fibrin. Now, what can you tell me about fibrinogen right here? Is fibrinogen active or inactive? It's inactive, right? Because of what? That O-gen. You see O-gen right there? It's inactive. Well, what happens if you cut yourself and you started to bleed to death and you didn't have fibrinogen? How long would it take you to make enough fibrinogen or enough fibrin? That might take you a week. And by that time, well, chances are you're gone, right? So your body makes a lot of the precursor to fibrin, which is fibrinogen. And fibrinogen, when you need it, is converted into fibrin by that thrombin molecule. Okay, so this whole mechanism, stage one, stage two, and stage three, is set up this way so that you can make a lot of fibrin in a hurry when you need it. We just call that a cascade. And it's actually kind of a positive feedback mechanism that makes a lot of fibrin all of a sudden. So let's take a look at and see what fibrin looks like. Remember what a red blood cell looks like? Okay. And when we put a net around it, it looks just like that. So this right here is a blood clot. We can see, can you see this individual red blood cell right here? And another red blood cell right here? And they're all grouped together with this net on top of them. And what's the name of this protein? What's the name of that protein molecule right there that's trapping all these red blood cells and white blood cells and forming a clot? That would be the fibrin. And before fibrin, there was fibrinogen, which was just a protein that dissolved in your blood and it didn't form this net. But it's thrombin then that forms this net, and it traps all these red blood cells and it closes off that injury to the blood vessel so that you don't bleed to death. Okay, so if we were to think of, let me go back to one of the previous slides. If we think of coagulation, what is the whole point of coagulation? What does it produce in our body? I think of one molecule. I think maybe you said it, maybe I heard it. It produces coagulation. I'll just put an arrow right here. It produces what? Fibrin, which is that net. So I'm sure that's a study question in the back of the chapter. Okay. It produces fibrin that seals off that blood vessel when it gets damaged. And it's really easy to see right there. Okay. It forms that fishnet. All right, what are some other interesting things? Oops. Other interesting things right here. Okay, so for good clotting function, for good blood clotting, we need to have a number of things, right? You might have decreased clotting function. That means that you might have a tendency to bleed when you get cut, which is not really a good thing necessarily, right? Maybe you have decreased vitamin K in your diet. Vitamin K is necessary to make blood clotting factors. And so K here, I don't mean potassium. I don't mean the element K, potassium, but I mean actually vitamin K. that's an organic molecule that you have to have in your diet because your body can't make it. Any kind of vitamin your body can't make. Does anybody know a source for vitamin K? What do you have to eat? Yeah, it's going to affect your clotting when you eat it. So people that are on anticoagulation therapy, if they're on heparin or Coumadin, they have to be concerned a little bit about what they eat, because if they eat too much of that vitamin K, they're going to clot anyway, even though they're taking anticoagulants. Lemon, that might be the opposite. I'm not familiar with lemon. But vitamin K, yeah, special K. That's close. Right? We can get closer still. Vitamin K is in green leafy vegetables, like broccoli and spinach and things like that. All right, now, who loves broccoli and spinach and all those kinds of things? Yeah, they're good. They're good for you because it gives you good clotting function. Okay? Unlike my nephews, my little nephews, when they were three, four, five, they'd roughhouse around, okay, and they'd be tumbling around the room, and all of a sudden somebody would get a bloody nose, and they'd come crying, uncle, my bloody nose, and I would give them a little sympathy, but not a whole lot, okay, I'd say, okay, just hold your nose shut, put your head back like that. But during supper time, these kids would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli or spinach, okay, so they were deficient in this vitamin here necessary to produce clotting factors, so for sure they would have reduced clotting function. Okay? As a matter of fact, now I think they're in college and they still don't listen to me, but they don't play quite so hard. They don't suffer from nosebleeds. But maybe you have some kids like that. They can probably prescribe, but I think it's better to do it with diet. Okay? Better to do it with diet. Oh, it is hard. It is hard, but it's rare that a kid will bleed to death. They might get bloody noses and things like that, but yeah. Then if that's the case, if it's a serious problem, if they just won't eat anything green at all, then maybe, okay, a vitamin supplement will help. Yeah, vitamin supplements, yeah. Just a daily. Just a multi-daily. Okay. But that also has some other ramifications. Namely, if somebody is on anticoagulation therapy, maybe they did get a valve transplant in a heart, and people are concerned about forming blood clots in their own body. They have to be on Coumadin or heparin or other kind of anticoagulant, and they have to adjust the level that they get. All right, they have to go to a blood clotting clinic in the hospital, and they measure clotting function, and they adjust the level of these of Coumadin that you get every day. But if you change your diet, guess what happens to your clotting function? If all of a sudden you eat a lot of salad with raw broccoli in it, all right, then your clotting function goes way up, and if you take a level of Coumadin from when you're not eating broccoli, then what? You're in trouble of maybe producing too much blood clotting. So people that are on these kinds of therapies can't change their diet from day to day. If you like broccoli and eat it, that's fine. Just eat it every day so that you can adjust the levels of Coumadin properly for you. Yeah, you should either eat it every day or abstain from it every day or eat just a little bit, okay? But don't change your diet a lot if you're on that kind of medication. Yeah? Good. Any kind. It's good, healthy for you because it's also bulk, which is cellulose, undigestible material. For her, no. It's only when you're on these drugs that you have to be careful. But if you just do it naturally, your body will be able to naturally adjust. But if your body can't naturally adjust, then you have to be careful how much you eat every day. Okay? That's no big deal. Okay, and what else for clotting function? You need calcium and you need those platelets. And the liver makes clotting factors, so you need to have a healthy liver in order to do that. So if you drink a six-pack of beer every day, guess what organ hurts? Six-pack, I'll tell you, a six-pack of beer is not very much, I don't think, but that's enough to kill your liver, huh? Every day. Yeah, every day. I don't think that's very much, but that's enough to kill your liver in a relatively short period of time through cirrhosis, which is going to, of course, affect a lot of things, including blood clotting function. Mm-hmm. Wine is okay. Yeah. Wine supposedly is magical. Okay, I don't know if that's true or not, but as long as you don't kill your liver. There was a very famous baseball player that died not too long ago. I think it was Mickey Mantle, who was an alcoholic, and he killed his liver through alcohol, and he got a liver transplant, but it didn't really help him very much, unfortunately. Okay, so fibrin formation, all right, fibrin formation is what kind of process? Fibrin formation is blood clotting, but what's another name for blood clotting? Coagulation. So coagulation, fibrin formation, coagulation. Okay. You might have this slide in your notes, but I don't really go over it too much, just in passing, and I don't have a question on the test. Is this right here? Okay. Control of blood clot formation. Okay, we said that if you cut yourself and you start bleeding, you want to coagulate that site. You want to stop bleeding. But one thing you don't want to have happen is to have that blood clot start, say, in your arm and go where? Everywhere all over your body to stop blood from flowing, because then you'll die, right, just like that. So there has to be other processes to make sure that blood clotting happens where it needs to be, but that it doesn't travel around your body, right? And we call that clot dissolution. So there is a compound in your body that's called plasmin, and plasmin is an enzyme that will actually break a blood clot down, right? And that's really handy. Maybe you might think, well, gee whiz, I had somebody I know get a stroke in their brain because a blood clot formed in their brain. Gee whiz, maybe we could have given this person plasmin to dissolve that blood clot in their brain and they wouldn't have had a stroke. Okay, so this actually is becoming a very important kind of chemical to know about, as well as one other one. It's been very, very helpful. But notice how plasmin is contained in your body when you're healthy. Plasminogen, what does that mean? Active or inactive? It's inactive. So plasmin is inactive, and it gets activated by thrombin, which is the same thing that activates fibrinogen into fibrin. So it's always a balance between producing a clot and dissolving it away in your body, right? There's always this yin and yang or antagonistic control that gives you the precise homeostatic control in your body. And so thrombin, and there's another chemical compound in your body called tissue plasminogen activator. We just call it TPA. TPA produces plasmin. And what does plasmin do? It dissolves clots. So when people are having a heart attack due to a clot, or maybe a stroke that's due to a clot, and if we can get the diagnosis quickly enough, we can give them TPA, for instance, and that will produce plasmin, and that will dissolve the clot, and that will protect their heart or maybe part of their brain. And the other kind of chemical that will do that is streptokinase. So TPA and streptokinase are two drugs that can be given to dissolve blood clots. I don't know if they're given to people that have blood clots, for instance, in their legs. I think our vice president has got a problem with one of his legs with a persistent blood clot in one of his veins, and he might be on one of these kinds of therapies to try to dissolve that clot. Okay, so this isn't on your test, but you might have heard of some of these things. And in L.A., it's pretty common, because in L.A., we've got some really sophisticated hospitals like Long Beach Memorial, right, or Cedars-Sinai, and they can play around with some of these advanced kinds of techniques. Yeah. Yep. Thrombin is an enzyme. So it's an enzyme that can convert fibrinogen into fibrin. And it also changes plasminogen into plasmin. Yep, that's what thrombin does. Okay. So, let's see, what do I got? One more slide after this? I got slide number 878. Yeah, I got one more. Okay, I'm just going to tell you what I'm going to tell you next time, but we're not going to go over this whole slide, but I'll just tell you what we're going to look forward to doing. All right, so when we make fibrin, what do we call that process of making fibrin again? Coagulation, okay? There is another kind of process, and we call that other process agglutination. So these are two big words, coagulation and agglutination. They both have to do with blood. But agglutination is a process that happens to you when you get a transfusion reaction. Your blood will clump together, but that's not coagulation, because coagulation is due to fibrin formation. When you get a transfusion reaction, your blood starts clumping together because of an antibody antigen reaction. So it's a different thing altogether. So next time I'm going to talk about blood types and blood grouping and antibody antigen reactions in blood, something we call agglutination, which is totally different than coagulation. Because coagulation is just what? Fibrin formation. But agglutination is that antibody antigen reaction. So if you want to read that over the weekend, that probably would help a little bit. It's not too terribly complicated, but it's just different. Okay? Who wants to get some quizzes back?